The House will come to order if members can take their seats.
This budget is a huge job maker, and the number one solution to economic insecurity is a job.
Hungry children can't learn, and it's our responsibility to try to help.
Equality and opportunity.
I believe most people are here because they want to do some good.
Welcome to the 16th episode in the 17th season of Capital Ideas. It's the podcast where members of the majority Democrats in the Washington State House of Representatives sit down at the Capitol and talk about ideas. Today we're talking with Representative Adam Birnbaum in our 10th conversation out of 10 with first-year members of the House Democratic Caucus here in Olympia. It's great talking with the veterans who can use their years of experience to put certain things into context, but it's the newcomers who bring fresh energy and ideas into the legislature, and we're fortunate to have such a big group this year. Next week, we'll be back to committee chairs and caucus leaders, but this has been a fun stretch of shows. Adam Birnbaum works for the people of Washington's 24th District, which is pretty much the entire Olympic Peninsula from Ocean Shores all the way up to Nia Bay and over to Port Angeles, where Adam lives, Sequim, and Port Townsend. We talked on Thursday, April 3rd, 2025, and you'll hear that conversation right now. Welcome to Capital Ideas, Representative Adam Birnbaum from the 24th District upon the beautiful, beautiful Olympic Peninsula. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This will be obviously your first time on Capital Ideas. We've had a whole lot of new members here, and that's a series that we've been continuing. Given that this is your first session in the House of Representatives, let's give people a little bit of chance to know you. I know that you're known in your district, or you wouldn't be here. But there are 48 other districts where people might be going, who is this guy? So, who is this guy?
I have always had some interest in politics. I taught abroad for a couple years after college, and I was living partially in northern Iraq and partially in Beijing. And I got very interested in nationalism, and I pursued a PhD in political science, initially anchored around that topic. And I realized about myself at a certain point that loved learning, loved reading books. It was pretty distant, pretty far from things. I got a job as a policy analyst, and you know, that was a little bit closer. I was living in D.C. at the time, so working on criminal justice and behavioral health issues. I grew up outside of Spokane. My wife was my now wife, then long-term, long-distance girlfriend, was still living in Washington State, and we were sort of at a moment in the relationship, and it became, you know, it made sense for me to come back, and I left the policy analysis job and got more involved in politics. This is a winding way of saying I've had a circling interest in politics that led me eventually to be the legislative assistant for now former Senator Kevin Vandeweghe. And when he stepped down, I decided to run for a seat. You asked who I am, and I gave a description of how I came to be an elected official, which is some type of statement on where my mind is at this point in session. But
I think most people at this point in session, I think this is day 82 or something like that. Burnout's not the right word because I see a lot of energy, but certainly people are getting wrapped up tighter and tighter as the session goes on.
Say the heat to light ratio in that energy is increasing.
Correct.
I think that there's something cool about the feeling of community here that is very hard to put your finger on, but it's a lot of people who have a pretty all-encompassing passion for the same set of stuff. And it's, I think, profoundly tedious for most people who aren't here, but I love it.
You're on several committees here. You're on agriculture and natural resources, which is perfectly sensible given the district that you represent. You're also on transportation, and that's been in the news the last few days. The transportation budget just passed, the House version of the transportation budget. Now the give and take with the Senate. How did you find the process coming in as a freshman of being on a committee that had to write a budget in a really tough budget year?
I had some expectations for what it would be like from my time working for a senator, And I got to say, I really like Cherify's approach. Not saying this to sound like a sycophant or to be too much of a homer for my team here, but I think that it was very principled the way he went about it, more so than I was expecting. I cynically anticipate, in particular, when you're crafting a budget with the amount of impact on local communities, a lot more horse trading, a lot more members really pushing for a project in their district saying, hey, I got to go home to my community and say that I got this done. And it's challenging because almost all those projects have merits. I don't think there are a lot of people here who are trying to build a bridge to nowhere. It's important fixes to roads and bridges in their communities that they're working on. At the same time, if everybody got every single project that they wanted, we would be in a terrible place financially. And the task given to us this year was not a fun one. It was to fill a significant hole in the budget. It was not to play Candyman. And I think that Vi did a pretty good job. So I was genuinely impressed by the thoughtfulness and the principled way the House budget was drafted. That's a sincere sentiment. I'm a vice chair on the transportation budget, so I got to be in the budget cabinet meetings on the House side for the transportation budget, at least. And it was also a pretty steep education curve for me. You could spend a very long time reading through some of this stuff, more time than you have. So I've definitely got some work that I'm looking forward to over the interim as we keep working, keep pushing this forward.
You know, one of the things that was remarkable is that even during the debate on the House floor, which got a little heated at times because there are a lot of people with a lot of opinions, but the one thing that seemed to have been consistent is that even on the Republican side, Chair Fye was praised for the fair and inclusive way he conducted the entire process of coming up with this budget, which did pass with a 2-to-1 bipartisan margin.
Yep. I think it's a pretty positive testament to the way he runs that committee that even though this is a pretty tense time in general, the work that he did leading up to that vote carried through.
Tell me about your bills. Tell me about two of your bills that you either feel a strong connection to or that you feel like these are going to change life for at least someone in Washington State for the better.
Yeah. Thank you for the question. And I will preface this by saying that as a freshman, what you do is you pick up a bill or you pick up bills that other people stakeholdered. So I always feel silly. The idea that I should get credit for any of the stuff that I'm doing this year doesn't quite sit right with me because it's mostly reflecting the good work product of other people that prepped the materials and laid the groundwork for these bills before I was elected.
That's remarkably honest.
Thank you for saying that. it is the truth. So, big air quotes, my bills. But I think there are two that were substantive this year that I worked on, several others that were companions to bills or were technical corrections bills that I won't describe. One of them is a bill that makes it easier for us to more efficiently utilize ECAP slots. Sometimes there will be an ECAP classroom. ECAP's early learning. There will be an early learning classroom that will have a couple empty slots, and there will be a lot of kids that could utilize those slots, but they're just a little bit too old. This bill allows them to utilize those slots. So pretty small change, but I think an important change. We're really trying to get bang for our buck in the early learning child care space. And what the bill does is it allows us to be a bit more efficient with the administrative overhead that comes with the program by maximizing our utilization.
Yeah, it doesn't detract from the other X number of kids that are in this class at a given time to have one more person whose birthday was 2 days before the cutoff.
Yeah, the kids that came that had birthdays before the cutoff, they get to go first. And if there's extra spots, just lets kids that come after the cutoff utilize those spots.
I was wondering about that because I had read not the bill, but the bill report, and I wasn't real clear on whether somebody who was a day too young might also be able to do it. That's good to know.
Yeah, so I don't believe we allow two-year-olds, even a very old two-year-old, which is a funny thing to say, is still not allowed into that program. And then the other bill is a prescribed burn bill. This bill follows up on a significant amount of work that the state has done to establish a burn boss certificate program to make it easier for us to do prescribed burns, which are important because we have a ton of volume, a ton of material in forests that goes up during wildfires. A couple hundred years ago, depending on the part of the state that we're talking about, tribes would have been handling with prescribed burns themselves. And that type of forest management over the last couple hundred years fell out of fashion, I suppose one way to say it. I was talking to a tribal partner about this who was describing a scene from a book that he read about what Lewis and Clark saw when they came to Washington and how the skies were full of smoke from these prescribed burns. So the hope is not for all of our skies to be full of smoke today, but it is for us to make it a little bit easier for folks to engage in prescribed burns. I can get into the weeds for what the bill does if you'd like, but the high level deals with some insurability liability issues that inhibit prescribed burns sometimes.
And the end result, we hope, will be fewer wildfires by getting rid of some of the fuel in a controlled manner.
Exactly. And also, eventually, I said I wouldn't go to the weeds. I'll go a little bit into the weeds. One important mechanism that's missing right now is insurers. And in general, the insurance marketplace is in a pretty bad spot. California implemented a similar policy. They've never had a claim filed in this program. The state was created, and one insurer re-entered the market. This is another way of saying we're potentially putting up public dollars to pay for some damages in the case of escapement now. One of the consequences down the road is inviting private dollars to come back in and insure this practice again, which is an important step for us to take if we're going to implement this policy in a more widespread manner. And the type of insurance that I'm talking about is insurance that would cover prescribed burns, but a private market insurer. And because we cap some of the damages that the state will pay to cover, it changes the viability of private insurance covering more damages above that threshold that we cap. So okay, it's a little technical, but it's something that we've seen work in other jurisdictions, and that we really need to encourage. So there's 1.5 million is the most conservative estimate for forests that need some type of treatment. For 1.5 million acres of forests is the most conservative estimate that I've seen. So that's a lot of work that we have to do.
And so one intended result of this, like many bills, is that the taxpayer, essentially, when we talk about the government paying for something, we're talking about the taxpayers paying for something.
That's right.
And this could reduce the tap on the taxpayer's wallet.
Oh, I would argue, I suppose I can't say that I think it absolutely will, but that is certainly the intended effect. We spend a ton of public money fighting wildfire, providing remediation when wildfires escape. And it's the more out of control wildfires we have, in addition to the first order costs that are felt by communities that are destroyed, the loss of human life, as the propensity for wildfire increases, it becomes more expensive for homes to get insured in areas in the wildlife-urban interface. It becomes more challenging. Anyway, you can imagine how there are these second order effects that we mitigate as well. So it should reduce public costs. It should reduce private costs in the long run.
And both of these bills have made it to the Senate. Is this correct?
That's right. One of them is hanging out. The prescribed burn bill is hanging out in Senate Ways and Means, scheduled to be exact on the last day of cutoff, which I could be more comfortable about, but that's where it is right now. And it's a pretty bipartisan bill, you know.
Long as it gets there before midnight.
That's the hope. That is the hope.
Good luck.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Let's talk about bills that you haven't run. And by that, what I mean is, what are some of the priorities that you see as a lawmaker now, as a human, that you feel like this is an area in which I would like to have a hand in making Washington a better place to live, work, and raise a family?
I appreciate that question. I'd like to work on some consumer protection issues that are important to me. I'd like to spend a bit of time, in particular over interim, thinking about the efficiency of some of our agricultural natural resource regulations. One thing that I love about the agricultural natural resource space is there are a ton of values that get evoked when you're talking about these issues. There's a question about the economic viability of farms, question about the workforce. How can you have like a workforce that is engaged on farms? How can you produce competitive products in a marketplace while preserving the environment, while maintaining some thought about the conservation ethic, while maintaining a high quality of life for animals, if animals are involved in those agricultural activities? And we can be a little blunt in our approach to trying to preserve or advance some of those values, and taking a step back and saying, okay, what is it costing us to advance some of these values, and what are we getting for some of those costs? Going through that exercise is something that I'm looking forward to. Those are some of the things that are on my mind. Always working on economic development in rural communities. How do we attract more investment? How do we lower cost? Big picture, constant questions, less than specific deep dive projects.
Have you found being a member compared to being a legislative assistant? Both of those jobs are hard. Both of those jobs involve long hours, and yet they're worlds apart. How has this transition been?
You know, an interesting thing that I was reflecting on this morning is I know a lot less now than I did as an LA. I perceive that to be the case. I had time in my day as an LA to kind of read things in a way that I don't, or I very seldom do now. The scheduling pressure means you're making a lot more decisions and you often have less context. And so I think the biggest transition that I see is, as a member, you are a lot more reliant on finding people that you trust. You're leaning on relationships where you have to take somebody's word about what something does. You don't have the capacity on your own. And I think the decision fatigue is a lot more profound. You're trying to figure out how you're going to vote on any number of bills in committee on the floor. That is more challenging, I think. I think as an LA, there's a constantness to the work. It is also, or I found it to be, more satisfying in terms of the completion of a task. Someone emails you, they aren't connected to their benefits, you help them get connected to the benefits, put a stamp on it, you're done. And there's a lot less like that right now. So they're very different jobs. I think the feeling of satisfaction is bigger when you get to work through a big issue. But as a freshman member, I'm in a listen and learn mode. I'm a part of the team here.
I have a strong feeling, without knowing even who your LA is, that you treat your LA with respect.
I try to. So my LA was my session aide when I was in LA. So Ryan and I have gotten to work together for a few years. And Ryan does a killer job. He's great.
That's an important, important job. Adam, we've been talking for a half hour. That's how long I had you scheduled for. And at this point, I want to wrap things up, but I want to do so by saying, now that we're close to the end, is there anything you want to toss out here that you haven't mentioned or that you want to leave as a closing thought?
I appreciate your time. 32 minutes is about 30 minutes longer than most people want to talk to me for. So thank you for your patience, and I appreciate you having me on.
I've enjoyed every minute of it. Thank you, Adam Birnbaum, Representative Adam Birnbaum from the 24th Legislative District. I appreciate your time. And appreciate the work that you're doing for the people of Washington. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a good one.
You too. Thanks for tuning in to Capital Ideas. Whether this is your first time or you've been with us since the podcasting pioneer days of 2009, you can subscribe and never miss an episode by finding us on your favorite podcast provider or by visiting the House Democratic Caucus webpage at housedemocrats.wa.gov. Once you get there, click on the media button at the top, then hit Capital Ideas in the drop-down menu. I hope you will, because what we talk about here is your state government, and what happens here matters more now than it ever has. I'm Dan Frizzell for the Washington State House Democrats, putting people first since 1889, the year of the Johnstown flood. Thanks for your time.